This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Als Gründerinnen und Gründer willst du vor allem eins, schnell vorankommen. Egal ob beim Product Market Fit, deinem nächsten Schritt oder deinem ersten großen Enterprise Deal. Doch mit KI, die Entwicklung immer schneller macht, steigen auch die Anforderungen an Sicherheit. Und das früher als je zuvor. Wer Themen wie Security und Compliance richtig angeht, ermöglicht Wachstum. Wer zu lange wartet, bremst es aus. Deshalb setzen viele Startups früh auf Wanta und wachsen sicher weiter. Wanta macht es einfach mit tiefen Integrationen, starker Automatisierung und kontinuierlichem Monitoring, das mithält. Und wenn es ans Audit geht, seien Wochen bereit, nicht erst in Monaten. Jetzt starten auf wanta.com. Als Gründerinnen und Gründer willst du vor allem eins, schnell vorankommen. Egal ob beim Product Market Fit, deinem nächsten Schritt oder deinem ersten großen Enterprise Deal. Doch mit KI, die Entwicklung immer schneller macht, steigen auch die Anforderungen an Sicherheit. Und das früher als je zuvor. Wer Themen wie Security und Compliance richtig angeht, ermöglicht Wachstum. Wer zu lange wartet, bremst es aus. Deshalb setzen viele Startups früh auf Wanta und wachsen sicher weiter. Wanta macht es einfach mit tiefen Integrationen, starker Automatisierung und kontinuierlichem Monitoring, das mithält. Und wenn es ans Audit geht, seien Wochen bereit, nicht erst in Monaten. Jetzt starten auf wanta.com.
BBC Sounds. Music, Radio, Podcasts.
I'm David Aronovich. Welcome to The Briefing Room, the audio mind space where you, me and top experts come together and inside 28 minutes wrangle a big issue. On Monday, the Northern Ireland Protocol was slated to be ditched and the Windsor Framework appeared and Brexit was declared done. But now the experts have had a chance to examine it, what's actually in the framework? And are all our problems solved? Brexit created huge problems for Northern Ireland, problems which were supposed to be solved by the protocol agreed between Boris Johnson's government and the EU. But it turned out that the protocol was creating new problems. On Monday, these were declared solved by Rishi Sunak and the President of the European Commission, Ursula von der Leyen, when they presented the Windsor Framework, and declared not solved by Boris Johnson earlier today. So, what's in the framework? Can it work? And does it mean Brexit is, as is being claimed, finally done? Step into the briefing room and together we'll find out. This task sounds challenging, so I've called on four briefing room regulars to help us properly but painlessly understand the Windsor framework. Peter Foster is the Financial Times public policy editor. Sam McBride is Northern Ireland editor of the Belfast Telegraph and Sunday Independent. Anand Menon is director at UK in a Changing Europe. And Jill Rutter is senior fellow at the Institute for Government. Peter, if I can start off with you, what is the protocol and why has it been such a problem?
So the protocol is the deal that Boris Johnson signed, as you said, that ensured there was not a return to a trade border in Northern Ireland. Remember, with Brexit, the border between Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland becomes an external border of the EU. And in order to avoid that becoming a trade border, Boris Johnson signed a deal that agreed that Northern Ireland would follow EU rules and regulations for goods. But if you're not going to have a border north-south, you're going to have a border east-west. And so the deal necessitated essentially a trade border in the Irish Sea between Northern Ireland and Great Britain. And that trade border upset a lot of people, a lot of unionists, particularly in Northern Ireland. It caused frictions for businesses and has actually soured relations between the UK and the EU pretty much since it came into force on the 1st of January 2020.
Jill, briefly, why did the EU insist upon it, given that it was likely to cause problems?
Because one of the EU's big red lines was to protect what they call the integrity of the single market. Any goods circulating in Northern Ireland, they assumed could just, because there would be no land border in the island of Ireland, reach Ireland inside the EU single market and go from there without any of those checks into the rest of the EU. So they were saying in order to protect the integrity of our single market, we need to be sure that goods in Northern Ireland meet our standards.
So, Sam, why has it been, from your vantage point in Northern Ireland, why has it been so problematic politically in Northern Ireland?
There are two ways to answer that. First of all, in practical terms, there have been a host of practical problems. So this was about trade barriers between Great Britain and Northern Ireland. Northern Ireland is about 2.8% of the UK population. It's a very small market for most British companies. And lots of them simply looked at this and said, look, we simply could not be bothered with this. We're not selling to Northern Ireland anymore. There were then other products, quite specifically, which were simply banned from Northern Ireland. So even if a British company wanted to sell a bare root apple tree with a few molecules of British soil on its roots to Northern Ireland, that was banned outright. No matter how many forms they filled in, it simply could not come here. These were rules which in many cases were designed for whole containers of a product, maybe whole ships of a product coming into the EU from China, from Brazil. They were never designed for a single country's internal market where small quantities move back and forth. So they were never really going to work here, frankly. But that was just the practical stuff. The real nub of this is the politics. And for unionists, in many cases, this made them feel less British. They felt like they were being pushed away from Britain. And at the same time, because the Irish Republic is obviously in the EU, they were coming closer to the Irish Republic and they didn't want that.
Right. And it now falls to you to begin the dissection of the Windsor framework. Now, in the first instance, what are the major differences between the Windsor framework and the protocol?
Well, let me start with the similarity, which is that under both, Northern Ireland continues to be under some EU rules, particularly when it pertains to trade for goods. And EU rules means that the ultimate arbiter of the legality of what happens in those areas is the European Court, the European Court of Justice. So the broad principles remain the same. But the major differences, I think, are the introduction of this green lane about which we've heard so much. So some of the practical problems that Sam was talking about have been addressed within the framework of the protocol. And also, crucially, this so-called Stormont break, which the government has sold as a veto over EU laws that people in Northern Ireland don't like, which the EU has said is a mechanism that will rarely, if ever, be used. But it is a way of giving Northern Ireland far more of a say, at least in principle, over the rules that govern it than was the case under the original protocol.
Now, Peter, Anand's referred to green lanes, which suggests that there are other coloured lanes, which we won't be as surprised to discover are red. What are they?
So, pretty simply, the red lane is for goods that are going from Great Britain into the European Union, into the Republic of Ireland, which is a member of the European Union. And when it's in the red lane, it faces the full panoply of checks, as it would as if it was going from Dover to Calais or from Dover to Rotterdam. The green lane is a special access route, which, you know, as Sam said, if you apply the full panoply of EU export controls, you end up with a massive border, internal border in the UK. So the green lane says, if you're pre-registered with a trusted trader scheme and you clearly label your goods as for consumption in Northern Ireland only, then you can get massively reduced checks. Now, that's clever thing about that is it's work for business still. But for consumers, they'll get access to the full range of products. And as Sam said, things like potatoes, seed potatoes and plants for the garden centres of Ulster will travel freely. And the big concession I think the EU has done there is they've basically recognised that the EU can accept that UK food standards and food rules are equivalent to the EU ones. And so goods, you know, the famous banger made to British standards can now go freely from Birmingham to Belfast in the green lane, as long as it's clearly labelled.
Peter, you've preempted my first quickfire question to Sam, which was on its website, the government's listed some of the things that were causing problems under the old protocol and then talked about how things were changing. I'm just going to pass a few across you very quickly. So it's true or false, really. Sausages and chilled meats were banned under the old protocol, but that problem is now fixed, they say. True or false?
Yes, that's true.
OK. Pets faced costly certificates and checks, but now that's fixed. True or false?
True.
That's true too. And access to medicines were impacted by EU laws, but that's now fixed. Is that true?
Mostly true. The slight caveat being that we were told that was true a long time ago and it actually turned out not to be true. Stormont's Department of Health is still saying it's looking at this, but it seems to at least be mostly true right now.
Right. Now, Sam, let's also look at this question of the green lanes, which are supposed to be totally trouble-free. And on Monday, the Prime Minister specifically said, given that we now have the green lane, burdensome customs bureaucracy will be scrapped. There just won't be any. Now, is that right?
Well, he actually went further than that the following day on Radio 4, where he said that there would basically be no customs whatsoever in the green lane. I wrote that that was highly misleading. He then came to Belfast on Tuesday, having read what I'd written, and said that I was completely wrong. But I think that he is wrong here. There is a clear requirement for the EU customs code to apply in Northern Ireland. There are still 21 data fields that have to be filled out, even once you get into the green lane, which requires registration with a trusted trader scheme. So you can't simply put goods in the back of a white van if you happen to own one in your company, drive to the ferry, bring it to a customer in Northern Ireland in the same way that you would elsewhere in GB. However, that does not mean that this has not been massively simplified. What are now 21 data fields had been 80 data fields. So it's much more practical, it's much more pragmatic. But in ideological terms, the simple answer is it's still there.
On Tuesday, the Prime Minister then said the Windsor framework would make Northern Ireland the world's most exciting economic zone. Jill, on what basis did he say that?
So he's saying that because Northern Ireland, for its goods, has access to the EU single market, free access to that, but it's also an integral part of the UK internal market. And what he's saying is only Northern Ireland can face both ways in that sense. This is a bit similar in, if your listeners remember, to one of the things that Theresa May was looking at for goods, where she wanted to have a common rule book on goods with the EU, and that would have applied to the whole UK. But he's now saying, you know, come and invest in Northern Ireland because they have this uniquely beneficial ability to trade in both markets.
Peter Foster, why don't you point out the obvious irony here?
Which is that if the single market's so brilliant for Northern Ireland, why isn't it so brilliant for everybody else? You know, I mean, Brexit took us out of the single market, piled bureaucracy on all of our traders, both in goods and services. And to see a prime minister who describes himself as pro-union, pro-Brexit, implicitly acknowledging that the single market is better for everybody, well, let's say that raised a wry smile among a few people.
Sam, has the Irish Sea border, which was such a problem for unions, has that now gone? And I should just say here that the former negotiator, Lord Frost, has argued that the government is guilty of some overclaiming when it said there is now no border in the Irish Sea. So who's right, Rishi Sunak or Lord Frost?
I think on this one, Lord Frost is correct. That's without passing any judgment on anything that he has done in the past in this regard, because he was obviously heavily implicated in putting in place the protocol, which was much worse than this arrangement in both practical and political terms. But I think that anybody looking at this with any objectivity would say that, yes, there is still an Irish Sea border. There is an Irish Sea customs border, a regulatory border. There are laws which will apply in Northern Ireland, which do not apply in other parts of the UK. So it has been softened. It has been camouflaged. Some of that is through enormous public spending to try to help firms get around this customs border in particular. And I think that Matthew Holehouse had it right earlier this week when he said that legally the claim by the Prime Minister that the border has gone is nonsense in strict legal terms. But from the perspective of a Belfast supermarket, it might seem true enough. And that's the interesting bit here. When people actually boil all of this down, do they actually care about the constitutional principles, or do they care that stuff's actually flowing freely into Northern Ireland and they don't notice it any longer?
A very interesting question, which we will look up. I should just say that Matthew Holehouse works for The Economist. And Anand, I'm afraid you have the unenviable task of telling us what the Stormont break is.
Well, the Stormont break is this mechanism that is meant to mean that people in Northern Ireland get to exercise a degree of consent over those EU rules. Remember, one of the democratic problems with something like the protocol or with being in the single market and not a member state is you live under rules over which you have no say. Now, the EU isn't going to give a non-member state a vote, but this is quite a clever solution, which means that if 30 MLAs in Stormont register disapproval of an EU measure, London can then, if London so decides, flag this up to the European Union and say we're not going to apply this. Now, that's not the end of the story. the bit of the story that the British government hasn't been so keen on is the EU might then decide to retaliate in some way if we do this. So it's not a free pass, but it does give that sense of consultation instalment that was missing in the original protocol.
Now, MLAs, we should just explain, are members of the Northern Ireland Assembly. Jill, why 30? I mean, how many MLAs are there? I believe there are 90. So 30 is just a third.
So this is using a procedure that already exists in Northern Ireland called the Petitions of Concern. So you need 30 MLAs from two parties. So it's designed to sort of allow, if you like, either community. In Northern Ireland, in the Assembly, people have to designate what community they are from. So it's designed to sort of give around enough of those, but they can't, on current numbers, do it just from one party, because neither Sinn Féin nor the DUP have quite enough MLAs to reach the 30 threshold.
And that was done so that a majority couldn't railroad a large minority into something they didn't want under the terms of the Good Friday Agreement.
So this is part of these things about sort of cross-community consent, to try and make sure that actually decisions respect the sort of principles of the Good Friday Agreement, that you have to sort of take the majority of people in Northern Ireland with you, and you can protect the rights of minorities, which, after all, was one of the reasons we're in this place in the first place.
Just so I understand this correctly, Sam McBride, Stormont would be able to propose blocking a new EU law, or rather 30 members of the Assembly would be able to, but the UK government would have the final say.
Well, yes, in most areas of this, but I think that actually, while on paper, all power is really in London, so it's not really a Belfast veto at all. It's not even really a Belfast break at all. At the final stage of this process, if it is disputed, that becomes external to the UK. So there's this arbitration panel, probably foreign lawyers, people who sit down and look at this objectively, and they say, is this reasonable? After all of the various stages that have been gone through, one of which is to say that this must be something which is significant, which is going to cause significant divergence between Great Britain and Northern Ireland. How's that defined? We don't know. Lots of questions around this, but I think that while this is something which I think is probably never going to be used successfully, it's not actually going to really work, it is not entirely worthless for two reasons. First of all, it is some leverage for Stormont with the EU. If they're really unhappy about a law, if they've got a valid reason to object, they can say, look, if you don't do this, we might go down this very cumbersome route and kick up a lot of dust. That's one thing. The second more significant thing is democratically. This gives some democratic legitimacy to what is happening here. Previously, EU laws were passed with no representatives of Northern Ireland having any say whatsoever. This doesn't give them anything like a veto, but it gives them some sort of say, and that's something.
That's very interesting. Jill, were you surprised that the EU conceded this break?
Well, it already conceded that there would be quite regular votes in Northern Ireland on the application of the whole protocol. And the UK already was able to say that a new EU law wouldn't apply in Northern Ireland, because that could only be done in the joint committee by the UK and the EU agreeing. So the additional bit that we have here is an ability for members of Stormont to raise concerns about a change to an existing EU law that's already applying in Northern Ireland. So was I surprised? I think the interesting thing here is that Sam has said it basically, I think they're betting that it won't actually materialise in practice. The barriers to using it are quite high, but it will force quite a lot of consideration of the Northern Ireland dimension before changes take place. I think that's the really important part of this.
Now, let's go on to the political impact of all this, and also, indeed, the chances of there being problems for the Windsor framework going forward. Now, Boris Johnson has said today that he'll find it hard to vote for this deal, and here's a quote from him. This is the EU graciously unbending to do what we want in our country, not by our laws, but by theirs. Now, Sam, firstly, is he right? And would the Northern Ireland Protocol he negotiated have given the UK more control?
Well, I think that if you take a strict, literal reading of what he says, yes, he is right in that there is real power that still resides with the EU. But that was a political choice which he made. I think that the level of brass neck that Boris Johnson has in this area is of really biblical proportions. I mean, there is this extraordinary situation where he was the person who negotiated this with his eyes open, with officials telling him what it meant. We know that from the government documents at the time. It's very clear there was an Irish Sea border. He knew that. He did it. He was able to defend explained that to his party. He got them over the line. He then lied about what that would mean. Then it turned out that that actually did mean what everybody had said it would mean at the start. And now that this awful deal has been improved significantly, and I think that anybody in Northern Ireland can see it's been improved significantly, whatever their political outlook on this, he is now trying to urge the DUP, it seems, from what some of the reporting was saying earlier this week, to be very cautious about it. I mean, I think what Boris Johnson looks like out of this is somebody who really doesn't care about the issue at hand, and somebody who has been using Northern Ireland consistently and very dangerously for his own ends throughout this process.
Now, before we get even more deeply into the politics and what the Johnson speech might mean, for example, for the DUP's stance, Jill, just on a technical level, does Rishi Sunak need a parliamentary vote to implement this?
No, not to implement most of the deal. The agreement that was passed by Parliament when they signed up to the Trade and Cooperation Agreement and within it and the withdrawal agreement gave the UK and the EU really quite stunning powers in the joint committee to agree changes. So most of it can be done through that. But the government has said it will legislate in some areas, and there may be some areas where it needs to just tidy things up a bit. And the EU also needs to legislate a bit. So one area it said is it needs to legislate to codify the operation of the Stormont break, and it's going to be consulting the parties on how that operates. But is this a sort of up and down to ratify it? No. So legally, he doesn't need a vote on the deal. Does he need it politically? Well, he seems to have judged that he does, because he said he is going to give MPs an opportunity to express their views.
Sam, the political situation in Northern Ireland right now, isn't it, is that the DUP is refusing to take part in power sharing until this question is resolved. What does the DUP make of this deal? Do you think it's going to accept it?
I think that there were seven tests that the DUP set out for this deal that they said it had to pass. It wasn't that it had to pass a majority of them, it had to pass all of them. There were things like putting back the Act of Union, Article 6 of the Act of Union about free trade within the British Isles as they then were, and between GB and NI as it now is. That sort of thing, quite detailed, quite technical, some of them written to be ambiguous, but actually when I went through them yesterday and I tried to analyse how many of these are met by the legal text, I could only come up with two of them that were clearly met by that. And some of them, really beyond any argument, are not met by that. So I think it's very hard for the DUP to back this. Already some of their people have come out and said they can't back it. I think they will sit on the fence for now. If there's an urgent vote on this in Parliament, that suits them, I think, because they can credibly say, we haven't had enough time, we're not going to be rushed. In 6 weeks' time, they can't do that. That's more awkward. And I think at some point they will go back into Stormont while grumbling loudly about this, while doing what, if you like, Boris Johnson does, trying to have their cake, trying to eat it, trying to eke out something else. But I think they do recognise this makes things much better for them.
And is this your impression as well? And also, if they are going to sit on the fence for 6 weeks, what impact will that have on Conservatives back in Westminster?
Well, what's been striking this week, at least, and for the moment, is the degree to which the usual suspects haven't piped up and expressed their opposition to the deal. So in that sense, I think it might not matter much at all for the Conservatives. There are some diehards who will go whichever way the DUP go. But I think actually the longer the DUP take, the more chance Sunak has to sort of square this with some of his backbench troops. The only thing I would add is if this happens after the budget and if there's significant backbench opposition to the budget because of a lack of tax cuts or whatever, these tend to be the usual suspects. So if there's a head of steam in a rebellion building up over something else, that might get marshalled behind this. But it's very, very hard to know for sure.
Right. Now, Jill, if the DUP does actually end up rejecting the deal and it goes through anyway, is that the end of devolution and the Legislative Assembly at Stormont?
Not necessarily, because as Sam said, that they could go back into government in Northern Ireland by saying that they've done their best to oppose a bad deal, but they accept reality. And, you know, the people of Northern Ireland want their devolved government back and need their devolved government back because there's a huge big backlog of decisions that politicians there need to make. So we can't really judge that, nor can we judge the timing of that. There are local elections, I think, coming up in Northern Ireland in early May, maybe at the DUP. Take a hard line till then and then find a way of going back into government. They may play it very long and decide they don't want to go back into government until there are new assembly elections. Those have been delayed until next year now, and they have a chance of becoming the largest party again and therefore don't have to serve under a Sinn Féin First Minister.
Well, Sam, that takes me to exactly where I want to go, because one thing you notice in these discussions of the framework is that other parties in Northern Ireland just about never get mentioned. And yet Sinn Féin not only won the last assembly elections and would therefore appoint the first minister, they're also the main opposition party in Ireland. Yet we don't seem to hear much from them on this. Is this our fault, or is this something to do with them being, I don't know, careful?
If you look at the history of Northern Ireland, there have been other points where Sinn Féin have been much more prominent earlier in the peace process. I think that the simple reality here is that it was the DUP who pulled down Stormont. They had the power to put it back. A few years ago, it was Sinn Féin who pulled it down. They had the power to put it back. And so that is the reality of what the Good Friday Agreement allows. It gives really significant clout to a relatively small party within Northern Ireland. It's not a majoritarian system. So what the majority think, which is pro-protocol, which is pro the EU, really doesn't matter that much in terms of this question of getting Stormont back. So it's an odd thing, but it is the reality. I think that most of those other Irish nationalist parties, north or south of the border, there has been no real controversy as far as they're concerned around this. A little bit of unease around this Stormont break, but I think as they've realised that it's not much of a break at all, certainly not a unionist veto, they are fairly relaxed about that. It eases some of the practical problems. They can live with that. That's good for their constituents. So that will not be a problem here, I don't think.
Peter, let's imagine for a moment that the DUP don't agree to support it, and some Tories say they will rebel, and there may be, as we've heard, some votes. What will the Labour Party do? And if the government has to rely upon Labour for its majority, is that a problem for them?
Oh, a very bad look for the Prime Minister, who has his position by commanding a majority in the House. I don't think that's at all likely. You know, from a Labour Party perspective, it's actually allowed them, by allowing them to back this deal, to be statesmanlike and bipartisan in a way, in fact, that they weren't when Theresa May was trying to get her deal across the line. I think it's also allowed them to highlight the fact that in lots of areas, and there are other areas of policy, this retained EU law bill, bits of the Bill of Rights legislation, where the Tory party, as Starmer never tires of saying, is being, you know, the tail is being wagged, or the dog is being wagged, the tail is being wagged by the dog. And actually one of the effects of this deal is actually it's rather sort of, you know, the tide's gone out, and in some ways Boris Johnson doesn't have his trunks on, I think. You know, that very hard line coterie of sovereignty above all costs wing of the Tory party that's driven so much of Brexit policy is kind of being found out, being faced down. And I think, you know, that's a big step forward.
Alan, do you agree with that?
Yeah, very much. I mean, having struggled with digesting Peter's various metaphors, yes, I think I do.
Jill, let's look at the, if you like, the kind of bigger, even bigger long-term question. Do you think that the Windsor framework successfully being implemented, going through and being implemented, would open the way to a reassessment of other aspects of the UK's relationship with the EU? In other words, I suppose I'm trying to say, has the atmosphere now very much changed?
I think the atmosphere was already changing from the sort of belligerent hostility era that we saw after the Trade and Cooperation Agreement was signed, when relations were frankly put into deep freeze and the EU broke off cooperation in a lot of other areas, so there wasn't progress on those. So I think it was very interesting. Ursula von der Leyen with Rishi Sunak on Monday was visibly very warm towards him. Everybody's talking about the dear Rishi. That's, in German, that's a slightly more normal thing to say, perhaps, than it is in English. But lieber Rishi, so, yeah, forgive her that. But she did sort of mention that we could go back and start looking at ratification of this UK membership, this big Horizon Science programme, which has been a big UK bugbear, that the EU had linked lack of progress on that to the UK's position on Northern Ireland, the failure to resolve that.
And I think, but I may be wrong, that Labour is hoping that over a period of closer relationship with EU will open up all kinds of other possibilities. Has this brought that possibility a step closer?
Essentially, yes, though only to a limited extent. I mean, actually, now that the protocol looks like it's been resolved, there's not that much of a difference between Conservative and Labour positions on Europe. You know, Labour will do an SPS deal, maybe a veterinary agreement, tinkering round the edges with what there already is here. In a sense, Sunak solving the protocol robs Starmer of the opportunity to get the big win of Horizon if he were the person to have solved the protocol. So to a limited extent, yes, Labour will take a slightly closer in power, I think, than the Tories would, but not to any massive extent. And crucially, not in the areas where the real economic impacts come from, which is the single market. So slightly.
I hate to do this to you, but I'm looking for a one-word answer nearly from each of you. Is this going to be our last briefing room on Brexit, Jill?
I hope so.
Peter?
No.
Anand?
No.
Sam?
Certainly not.
Oh, dear. Sam McBride, Jill Rutter, Anand Menon and Peter Foster, thank you all so much. And what do I make of all this? Well, it's pretty simple, really, isn't it? Brexit still isn't done. This is the last programme in the current series, but we'll be back next month. You've been listening to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The producers were Ben Carter, Kirsty Knight and Daniel Gordon. The editor was Richard Varden, and the programme was mixed by Rod Farker. If you enjoyed it, you can subscribe to our podcast by visiting BBC Sounds, where you'll find a whole back catalogue to listen to, including the one about how worried we should be by avian flu, the one about the Wagner Group, and the one on how we get over 50s back to work, or whether indeed we should.
Please, I beg you in the name of God, I need some assistance from you.
Who is worthy of our trust?
I just thought, this is very, very shady, and there's something definitely wrong about this.
He didn't believe me. I said, well, I'm not a scammer. I'm not a bad person.
Join me, Matthew Side, for the latest season of my BBC Radio 4 podcast, Sideways. 7 new stories of seeing the world differently and the ideas that shape our lives.
I need to figure out a way to really compensate him, or else I'm going to be the scammer that I accused him of being.
Sideways on BBC Sounds.
Ich bin Charissa und meine Empfehlung an alle Entrepreneure, startet mit Shopify erfolgreich durch. Ich verwende Shopify schon seit dem ersten Tag und die Plattform macht mir nie Probleme. Ich habe viele Probleme, aber die Plattform ist nie eins davon. Ich habe das Gefühl, dass Shopify ihre Plattform kontinuierlich optimiert. Alles ist super einfach, integrier und verlinkbar. Und die Zeit und das Geld, das ich dadurch spare, kann ich anderweitig investieren. Vor allem in Wachstum.
Jetzt kostenlos testen auf shopify.de.
Hello, it's Ray Winstone. I'm here to tell you about my podcast on BBC Radio 4, History's Toughest Heroes. I've got stories about the pioneers, the rebels, the outcasts who define tough.
And that was the first time that anybody ever ran a car up that fast with no tires on. It almost feels like your eyeballs are going to come out of your head.
Tough enough for you? Subscribe to History's Toughest Heroes wherever you get your podcasts.